You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 132, The Old Master. Thanks for joining me. As always, before we get started, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters. None of this would be possible without your help. I recently had a listener point out that not all podcast apps show you the release dates of these shows. I'm recording this episode in late 2025, so if you're listening to this at some point in the late 2020s or early 2030s, there is a good chance the show is still going on and still needs your help to keep going. Although, for all I know, by the time you're hearing this, I've been dead for years, and you're listening to my voice from beyond the grave, in which case you're off the hook. For everyone else, please visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon, and you can get access to all bonus episodes and help me keep the show going for as little as $2 a month. For those of you who are listening to these as they come out, this will be our last episode before Christmas, so I'll remind you one more time that gift subscriptions are available on Patreon. Anyway, last episode we discussed the end of Napoleon's marriage to Josephine. With that story over, we can move on to something completely different that I have been waiting for a break in the narrative to introduce properly, the origins of Spanish-American independence. In the next few episodes, we'll be discussing what at the time was called the Spanish Main, Spain's mainland colonies in the Americas, distinct from their possessions in the Caribbean, Africa, and Asia. By the Napoleonic period, these places had been part of the Spanish Empire for centuries. Some parts of Spanish America had been under the Spanish crown longer than the United States has existed at the time of this recording. Before Napoleon's invasion of Spain in 1808, there was little sign of that long-standing colonial status quo changing anytime soon. As we'll see later in this episode, Spanish America certainly had its problems, and its people had their complaints. But at the turn of the 19th century, few would have suspected that anything fundamental about the colonial relationship was about to change. This was not like the situation in the British North American colonies a generation earlier, whose revolution had a very long prehistory, over a decade of organizing and agitating by pro-independence forces, and a slowly building political crisis between the colonial governments and the mother country. There was nothing like this process going on in Spain's American colonies on the eve of their independence. By and large, the various diverse peoples of Spanish America were loyal to their king, or at least saw no plausible alternative. When news of Napoleon's invasion of Iberia reached the New World, most Spanish subjects responded by rallying around the crown. And yet, 16 years after the outbreak of hostilities, there would be no remaining Spanish foothold in mainland America. It was a remarkable change in a very short time. Somewhere just shy of 20 million people spread out across a massive territory between Northern California and the Tierra del Fuego suddenly thrust into a totally new diplomatic and political paradigm. And none of it would have happened, at least not when and how it did, without Bonaparte's decision to stab his allies in the back and occupy Spain. This is not really a core part of our story, so we will not be covering it at the same level of detail as other topics we've discussed in the past. But such a dramatic change, directly catalyzed by Napoleon's actions, demands at least some explanation. On the eve of independence, Spanish America was a place of strong hierarchies. This territory was divided into four separate colonies, called viceroyalties, each with its own royal governor, appointed by the king and empowered to act in his name. At least in theory, the position of royal governor was incredibly powerful. He was bound to act within the law and follow the king's orders, but Madrid was a long way away. A strong royal governor could operate almost like a monarch. The governors were backed up by a ruling class known as the peninsulares, or Europeans, people who were born in Europe, usually Spain, but had moved to the Americas, either as immigrants or temporarily to accept some government or ecclesiastical appointment. It is important to note that within Spanish colonial society, these people were not referred to as the Spanish, because many people born within the colonies considered themselves Spanish as well. In that entire stretch of land between California and the southern tip of modern Chile, there were only about 30,000 peninsulares. And yet, they were a privileged class that monopolized all the most desirable positions in colonial society. From the government administration, to the church, to the world of commerce and business, almost anyone who was anyone had been born in Spain. The Europeans looked on this exalted position as their birthright. After all, hadn't this whole empire been built on Spanish courage, Spanish ingenuity, and Spanish blood? The class below the peninsulares in the colonial hierarchy is usually referred to as the Creoles. In theory, anyone born in the Americas, whatever their background, was a Creole. In practice, the word generally refers to people of European, usually Spanish, ancestry who had been born in the New World. In this era, they were often referred to as Americans, which of course is perfectly logical and produced no confusion at the time, but it sounds a bit strange to modern ears, so in our next few episodes, I'll leave it untranslated in Spanish, Americanos. These Creoles, or Americanos, were a much bigger proportion of the population than the Peninsulares, probably somewhere around one quarter total, although this varied quite a bit from place to place. Like most colonial societies of this era, Spanish America had a racial hierarchy. As white people, the Creoles were at the top of that hierarchy. There were no official limits on their freedoms or legal rights. In theory, they were social equals with the Europeans. In practice, that peninsulare network of power was almost entirely closed off, and there was a lot of snobbery towards people born in the Americas. As you might imagine, this bred resentment among the Americanos, who were practically relegated to the status of second-class citizens in their own societies, left to watch from the sidelines while outsiders called all the shots and took the best of everything for themselves. Some Creoles became radicalized by this unfavorable status quo, especially after the outbreak of revolution in France. Liberal ideas began to spread in some quarters of the Americano population, but these radicals were few and far between, and even most of them were dreaming of reform, not revolution. The truth was, as much as the white Creoles resented the Peninsulares, they did have a stake in the colonial order. Generally speaking, they were freer and had more opportunities than their non-white neighbors. And so they had reason to fear those below them in the social order. To rebel slaves or indigenous warriors, a colonist was a colonist. Spain's international rivals didn't discriminate based on place of origin either. If France, Britain, or the United States invaded, it would be bad news for every Spanish subject, Creole or European. The Americanos grumbled about Peninsulare influence, but few of them imagined a future outside the Spanish Empire. Many of them wanted change in the abstract, but they were also generally afraid of the consequences of upsetting the status quo. The next class below the Creoles in the colonial social order was the mixed-race population. In fact, it's actually slightly incorrect to refer to this group as a singular class. Spanish America had a complicated system of racial classification. For example, a person with three white grandparents and one indigenous grandparent would be labeled a castizo, while a person with two white grandparents and two indigenous grandparents would be a mestizo. A person with mostly European ancestry but one black grandparent would be a morisco, not to be confused with an albino, who would only have one black great-grandparent. To modern ears, it's all a bit absurd, but these were societies built on hierarchy and racial privilege. These questions of ancestry were important in the Spanish Empire. Below the various classes of mixed-race people were the non-white population of Spanish America, the black and indigenous population. The indigenous peoples of the Americas had been through hell in the preceding centuries. In the wake of European colonization, perhaps over 90% of the indigenous peoples of the Americas were killed by disease. As the colonists spread their influence over the New World, abuse, warfare, and even outright murder had hindered any recovery. Some groups were wiped out entirely, as we saw with the Taino people of the Caribbean in our episodes on the Haitian Revolution. However, the indigenous peoples of the Americas held on and persevered. On the eve of the Spanish-American Wars of Independence, the indigenous people were probably still the largest single group in the colonies. There was a lot of variation here. Obviously, indigenous people is a category created by the arrival of the Europeans. Different groups all had their own cultures, languages, and ways of life that were sometimes almost as different from each other as they were from those of the colonists. Some indigenous Americans were well integrated into colonial society. Some lived very similar lives to those of their ancestors before colonization. Most were somewhere in between. There were places in Spanish America where indigenous people were hunted and abused, much as they had been in the early days of colonialism. However, official policy had softened a bit. Indigenous people still faced intense discrimination, but those that were not considered a threat to the colonial order were generally tolerated, if only because their taxes and labor were necessary to keep the colonies running. One thing that united almost all indigenous people in the Spanish Empire was the concept of tribute. Under Spanish law, every native group was deemed to owe a debt to the Spanish crown, payment for Spanish protection and administration, which, of course, very few of them wanted. It was also an act of ritual submission to remind everyone involved who was in charge. In the early days of Spanish colonialism, this concept of tribute was taken to brutal extremes, often used as an excuse to practically enslave indigenous populations and work them to death. By the Napoleonic period, it usually took the form of a special tax, or sometimes a corvée, a sort of tax on a person's time and effort, in which they were required to labor on public works projects some set number of days a year. There was not much of a place for indigenous people in Spanish colonial society, other than as manual laborers and taxpayers. Understandably, many did their best to avoid it entirely, disobeyed as much as they could get away with, or even revolted. Like almost everywhere else in the New World, Spanish America was a slave society. Those at the bottom of the social ladder were enslaved Africans and their descendants. They were not distributed evenly across the territory of the Spanish Main. Places where there was good land for plantation agriculture had huge black populations. Places that did not often had very few black residents, or even none at all. As I've mentioned in past episodes, slavery was slightly different in every colonial society. In Spanish America, there was actually a relatively large free black population alongside the thousands of enslaved people. They still faced pervasive discrimination, but there were some avenues open to social advancement. In fact, in the minds of some white colonists, there were too many avenues to social advancement. In the years before the Wars of Independence, this was a common complaint among the Spanish Creoles and Peninsulares, that the government had become too lenient on the free black population, who had consequently begun to forget their place. So as you can see, colonial society was fractured. The various groups of people who called Spanish America home all had their own grievances about the status quo, but those grievances did not necessarily overlap. However they may have felt about their connection to Spain, many of these groups were more suspicious of each other than they were of their colonial overlords. With all that said, there were many places in Spanish America where it was still possible to escape this rigid caste system. If you look at a map of the New World at the dawn of the 19th century, you will see all of Spanish America colored in, nice and neat, with no empty space. The reality was quite a bit different. Outside the big cities and administrative centers, this was still a frontier society. Looking back from the crowded 21st century, it can be hard to wrap our heads around just how sparsely populated this area was in this era. As I said at the beginning of the episode, there were probably just under 20 million people living in Spain's mainland North American colonies. That might sound like a lot, but we're talking about the whole area from the modern American West down to the Tierra del Fuego. It had about the same population as the modern country of Guatemala alone. In many parts of Spanish America, there were simply not very many people around. Without big concentrations of population, state control is impossible. This was not ideal for the colonial administrators, but many average people found it to be a blessing. There was freedom and autonomy in those empty spaces. Those lands beyond the reach of the colonial state could be cruel and unforgiving. If you were brave enough to venture there, there would likely be no one to protect you from threats, and no one to help you if something went wrong. However, there was also opportunity, rich land that was still legally unclaimed, and resources that had yet to be tapped. But there were also less tangible opportunities, the chance to be your own person, rather than allowing yourself to be defined by the strictures of Western society, the chance to get out from under that rigid hierarchy and live free. The people who lived on or near the frontier tended to be independent and self-reliant. They generally did not care so much about that somewhat ridiculous racial hierarchy. These were often punishing environments. When you're struggling to survive, you can't afford to be choosy about who you associate with. Out on the frontier, cultures, languages, and lifestyles blended together. So did the people themselves. Marriages and romantic relationships that might have been seen as scandalous in one of the big colonial capitals were much more accepted out on the frontier. Those big colonial capitals really were huge and impressive. I don't want to give you the impression Spanish America was totally undeveloped. In fact, in this period, most of the biggest and most important urban centers in the Western Hemisphere were in Spanish America. To take one example, in this era, Mexico City was over 3 times the size of New York City, on top of being over 100 years older and widely considered more culturally and socially advanced. Philadelphia was the only city in the USA that even came close to matching the size of the big Spanish colonial capitals, and that's only if you count the outlying towns and villages. The most important of the 4 viceroyalties of Spanish America was also the oldest, New Spain, roughly corresponding to modern Mexico, most of Central America, and maybe 2/3 or so of the western USA. New Spain had by far the biggest population of all the viceroyalties, and it alone was responsible for half the revenues of the entire Spanish Empire. This wealth came from a variety of sources, but by far the most important of these was the mining of precious metals, especially in the famous silver mines of San Luis Potosí. To the south was the Viceroyalty of New Granada, roughly corresponding to the modern countries of Panama, Colombia, and Venezuela, headquartered in the city of Bogotá. New Granada had a relatively big population, with several important towns and cities. There were also areas that were suitable for cash crop plantation agriculture, which, as we've discussed in past episodes, was incredibly lucrative in this era. However, in the eyes of its Spanish overlords, New Granada had never been quite as profitable as its neighbors. This was in large part due to its incredibly rough terrain, Much of this territory is dominated by the Andes Mountains and the surrounding highlands, and a lot of the territory outside the mountains is jungle. South of New Granada is, of course, Brazil, which is outside the scope of this episode, but also the Viceroyalty of Peru, corresponding roughly to the modern states of Peru, Ecuador, and Chile, with its headquarters at Lima. Peru had once been almost as profitable as New Spain, but by the dawn of the 19th century, the colony was in decline. Spain had launched a reorganization of its American colonies in the 1770s. In any big, sweeping reform, there are always winners and losers, and in this case, Peru had definitely lost out. The Viceroyalty had been stripped of most of the important gold and silver mines that had once been the source of its wealth. Peru still had several important urban centers, built over the ruins of the great Inca Empire, but on the eve of the Wars of Independence, its administrators were still struggling to adapt to the difficult new status quo. Those all-important gold and silver mines that had once been a part of Peru had been transferred to the newest Spanish colony on the continent, the Viceroyalty of the Rio de la Plata, roughly corresponding to modern Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia, with its capital at Buenos Aires. The Viceroyalty of the Rio de la Plata had only been around a few decades at the start of our story. It was the least populated and least developed viceroyalty, although it did have important economic engines in the form of those mines, and in the excellent natural ports at the mouth of the Rio de la Plata, the colonial capital of Buenos Aires on the south bank and Montevideo on the north. As is often the case with two port cities in close proximity, there was an intense rivalry between Buenos Aires and Montevideo. This rivalry would come to play an important role in the coming drama. The Rio de la Plata was also the only part of the Spanish Main that had seen significant fighting in the Napoleonic Wars. Back in 1806, when France and Spain were still allies, a fascinating and somewhat eccentric British admiral named Sir Home Popham had organized an expedition to seize the mouth of the Rio de la Plata with a squadron of Royal Navy warships and about 1,500 redcoats. Amazingly, Popham did this entirely on his own initiative. He had been dispatched from Britain months earlier with orders to seize the Dutch colony at the Cape of Good Hope in modern South Africa. Popham and his men achieved this relatively easily, and he decided to make this pit stop in Latin America on their way home without any orders from London. Even in this age of enlightenment, Spanish America was still a somewhat mysterious place to outsiders. Non-Spanish merchants were officially banned from trading there. Many did so anyway, but they were technically breaking the law, and so did not generally advertise their presence by writing about their experiences. Foreigners who even wished simply to visit needed the personal permission of the King of Spain. But Admiral Popham did actually know something about this region. Before leaving London, he had made the acquaintance of a very knowledgeable person who came from this part of the world, Francisco de Miranda. Miranda is a fascinating figure and a giant in Spanish American history. He probably deserves his own episode. To give a very brief introduction, he was born in the city of Caracas, New Granada, in 1750. His family was wealthy, but not of high social standing. As we've seen, Spanish colonial society could be incredibly snobbish. Even though the Mirandas were wealthy people of European ancestry who lived respectable lives, many of their so-called betters looked down on them. Miranda was an intellectual at heart and took to ideas and books at a very young age. He was a true man of the Enlightenment, not only in his intellectual interests but in his politics, which were definitely on the liberal side of the spectrum. Despite his Creole origins, he was able to get an officer's commission in the Spanish Royal Army, and saw combat in the service of the King of Spain. However, he harbored some very bold political ideas, beyond the usual Enlightenment program of liberalism, individualism, and rational constitutional government. Miranda was one of very few Americanos who dreamed of a future for his homeland outside the Spanish Empire. After leaving the Spanish army, he traveled widely, learning as much as he could and trying to generate interest in the idea of independence for Spanish America, all while trying to stay ahead of Spanish intelligence agents who were always working to have him arrested. Miranda had an amazing talent for finding his way to interesting and powerful people. He personally knew George Washington, Frederick the Great, Catherine the Great, Alexander Hamilton, the Duke of Wellington, Prince Potemkin, William Pitt the Younger, King Stanisław August, the last monarch of Poland, and the composer Joseph Haydn. And that's just to name a few. During the French Revolution, Miranda went to Paris to offer his services to the liberal cause. As you might recall, during the War of the First Coalition, the French were in dire need of experienced, politically reliable officers, and were happy to have him. Miranda quickly rose to the rank of general. At one point, he was actually the commander-in-chief of the Army of the North, one of the main field armies of Republican France. However, like many revolutionary generals of this period, he ran afoul of the government and wound up in prison, charged with treason. Miranda escaped execution and was eventually freed, but it had been very close. Perhaps understandably, this whole affair seems to have soured him on the revolution. He then began plotting with the counter-revolutionaries. However, his treachery was soon discovered, and he fled France before he could be arrested again. He wound up in London and went back to lobbying for Spanish-American independence. This is where his path had crossed with Admiral Popham. Miranda made it all sound so simple. He said the people of Spanish America were unhappy with the status quo. As we've seen earlier in this episode, that was true. He said the Spanish Main was full of valuable resources. Everyone in Europe knew that. As we've discussed in past episodes, in the preceding centuries, the wealth of the Spanish colonies had been great enough to transform the entire global economy. Miranda said the people of Spanish America were eager to buy British goods and could represent a very lucrative market. That was true as well. British merchants who had dabbled in the smuggling trade knew the demand was there. With France shutting off more and more of Europe to British trade, there was a lot of pressure to find new markets. Miranda was highly intelligent and charismatic. His arguments were all sound. No surprise, his ideas drew a lot of interest, including at the highest levels of government and the military. With all that backstory, perhaps it's a little less surprising that Admiral Popham had decided to go take the Rio de la Plata all on his own, with barely over 1,000 troops. It was all so logical. The people of Spanish America would be freed from Spanish tyranny, and British commerce would help them develop their economies. The British would add nearly 20 million customers and thousands of square miles of territory to their sphere of influence. It seemed like a perfect opportunity for all involved. All that was missing was someone with the guts to make it happen. Admiral Sir Home Popham believed he was that someone. British troops began landing outside Buenos Aires in mid-summer 1806. Everything seemed to go well. Popham got his men ashore to the sound of wild Scottish bagpipe music from the men of the 71st Highlanders, which must have sounded very strange to the locals. The British ground forces were led by General William Beresford, who we introduced in episode 128. After this adventure in South America, he would be assigned to the Portuguese forces during the Peninsular War, entrusted with rebuilding their armies to fight the French. The royal governor of the Rio de la Plata had gathered together a small force of militia to oppose the British landing, but he had no regulars at his disposal. There was a brief exchange of fire as the redcoats approached the militia, then the British officers ordered their men to fix bayonets and charge. A few militiamen lost their nerve and ran for the rear. Panic spread, and soon the whole force had disintegrated. The Spanish commander called out, quote, "What will the women of Buenos Aires think of you?" end quote. But apparently his men did not care. With the militia brushed aside, the approach to the city was wide open. The British marched on Buenos Aires. The Spanish governor fled the city. Some of the remaining militia attempted to defend Buenos Aires, but with their superiority in numbers, training, and firepower, the British made short work of them, losing only a single man and inflicting severe casualties on the enemy. Once the fall of the city became imminent, the remaining officials of the city government surrendered, and the Redcoats marched into the colonial capital. So far, everything had gone as the admiral had hoped. However, Popham seems to have misjudged the mood in Buenos Aires. Some local citizens did make nice with their conquerors. After all, this was a port city. Merchants generally do not stand on principle when there is money to be made. However, Popham and his men were not greeted as liberators by the general population. Citizens opposed to the British began organizing themselves into new militias. They had essentially nothing in the way of equipment, supplies, training, or experience. One of their officers would later recall, quote, "When the English invaded, I was not only ignorant of how to form a company in a line of battle or a column, but also how to order the men to shoulder arms. I had to rely on one of my sergeants or corporals to give the order," end quote. Still, all kinds of people joined up, European and native-born, rich and poor, slave and free, white, black, indigenous, and in between. Men from Montevideo volunteered to risk their lives for the freedom of their great rival city across the river. Whatever differences the people of the colony may have had among themselves, it seems the great majority could all agree they did not want the British in their country. This actually made some of the colonial elite very nervous. From a certain perspective, this should have been exactly what they wanted. People from all walks of life uniting to defend the status quo. But all classes of society joining together in a common cause, forming their own military units, and organizing themselves on their own, without instructions from Madrid or the royal governor, all set some very dangerous precedents. Still, what could they do? By this point, events had taken on a momentum of their own. This improvised militia army was led by one of the few Spanish colonial officials who had not fled with the governor. His name was Santiago de Liniers. As you might have guessed from that name, he was actually a Frenchman, but had spent most of his life in Spanish service. Liniers fled across the Rio de la Plata to Montevideo, where he set up his headquarters, which became a rallying point for all these new militias. He was able to pull together several thousand volunteers, artillery, and even an improvised naval squadron out of ships donated by local businessmen. They were even joined by a French privateer crew who had been using Montevideo as a base as they hunted British merchant ships in the South Atlantic. When everything was ready, they sailed across the Rio de la Plata, landing on the far bank with well over 2,000 men. Liniers sent a letter to General Beresford, the British commander inside Buenos Aires. Quote, "The fortune of arms is variable. A little more than a month ago, Your Excellency entered this capital without opposition and with a small number of troops. But today, with the highest enthusiasm to throw off your hated dominion, we will soon show you that courage is not unknown to the people of Buenos Aires. I am at the head of an army of well-organized troops, who are much superior to those under your command. The Navy will not let you escape, and thousands of the townspeople await no more than my signal to throw themselves against you." End quote. Beresford countered, quote, "I have no doubt that your army is numerically stronger than mine, but any comparison of their relative discipline is futile. Neither did I enter this city unopposed. To execute it, I had to twice defeat the enemy. Arms will decide its fate." End quote. We've seen poorly trained militia troops face off against seasoned regulars several times in past episodes. It almost never went well for the militia. In Napoleonic-era combat, training and discipline were huge advantages that were almost always insurmountable for irregular troops. But Ligné and his men knew what they were doing. They detoured around the city to approach from the more vulnerable landward side. The British were not prepared for an attack from this direction. By the time they knew what was happening, Ligné's militia were already inside the city. To their credit, the British recovered from this surprise very quickly. There was fierce combat in the streets of Buenos Aires, including a bloody bayonet fight right in the Plaza Mayor, the city's main public square. During this phase of the battle, a brave young militia cavalryman captured the standard of the 71st Highlanders. The urban terrain negated many of the advantages of the British regulars. They were outnumbered by about 2-1, and in a very unfavorable position, with their backs to the river, surrounded by a hostile population, and with their superiority in training and firepower practically neutralized. The Redcoats held out for a few days, but it soon became clear they had no hope of winning this fight. Early in the afternoon of August 14, 1806, the British forces in Buenos Aires raised the white flag. When General Beresford appeared to formally offer his surrender, Ligné threw his arms around his adversary and kissed him on both cheeks, in typical French fashion. He congratulated Beresford on a well-fought defense and offered very generous terms of surrender, which the British general accepted. What modern-day Argentinians refer to as La Reconquista was complete. Crowds of jubilant citizens marched through the streets, cheering the city's liberators, and dragging the captured flag of the 71st Highlanders through the mud and manure. Admiral Popham's grand dream of liberating Spanish America under British influence had only lasted about a month. Upon his return to Britain, Popham was court-martialed. Obviously, he was guilty, but he only received a slap on the wrist. The British government approved of what he had been trying to do, and the Royal Navy generally liked officers who took personal initiative. Popham's career continued essentially without interruption. Back on the Rio de la Plata, Santiago de Ligné was the man of the hour. The City Council of Buenos Aires voted to depose the royal governor, who had fled the city at the first sign of trouble, and installed the triumphant Ligné in his place. They did not have the authority to do this. Remember, royal governors were the personal representatives of the king himself. However, when the news reached Madrid, King Charles approved and confirmed their decision. This was an unprecedented event. If the colonials could organize their own military defense and choose their own leader, what more use did they have for Spain? This had started to occur to people, but at this stage, there was still no real independence movement. Meanwhile, as Admiral Popham's expedition fizzled out, his friend Francisco de Miranda was trying something similar on the other side of the continent. After his time in London, Miranda returned to the United States, as always hoping to drum up support for the cause. Through his powerful American friends, he was able to get a face-to-face meeting with President Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson and Miranda were birds of a feather. They would continue exchanging letters after this fateful encounter. Once the small talk was over, Miranda laid out an audacious plan, an amphibious military operation that would force a landing on the coast of his native country, then march south across the continent, gathering supporters from among the local population, until they had liberated all of Spanish America. Miranda hoped to form the Spanish American colonies into a united federal republic, much as the United States had tried to do with the British American colonies during its War of Independence. The president was very taken with this idea. This type of bold, progressive thinking was exactly his style. But, as president, he also had to think about his country's national interest. And the way things stood on the international stage, the USA had to pursue a policy of strict neutrality. He could not risk a war with Spain over Miranda's dreams. And so the sage of Monticello had to tell his new friend no. However, before Miranda took his leave, Jefferson reminded him that, under American law, there was nothing stopping private citizens from taking part in foreign liberation struggles. As long as no government officials were publicly involved, and the policy of neutrality was not threatened, many Americans might even look favorably on this endeavor. Miranda got the hint, and began organizing what 19th century Americans called a filibustering expedition, a private military invasion backed by wealthy investors. Unsurprisingly, Miranda had no problem finding financiers who were willing to bend the law and dabble in a little violence for a chance at a big payday, but recruiting soldiers and sailors proved to be a bit more difficult. The early 19th century USA was not exactly teeming with experienced mercenaries, and there was no large community of Spanish-American exiles to recruit from either. Sadly, Miranda and his backers often resorted to lying to potential recruits to get them signed up. He was eventually able to pull together a few hundred men and several improvised warships, and they set sail for the coast of modern Venezuela. The expedition was a fiasco. Miranda's men were poorly trained and poorly motivated. Many of them didn't even know what they had signed up for until they were almost ready to land. Miranda's friend, Admiral Popham, had been lucky to pounce on Buenos Aires when there were no Spanish regulars present to defend the city. Miranda himself was not so fortunate. This part of Spanish America was well defended. He and his men were eventually able to land and seized the town of Coro. But the Spanish authorities had already been alerted to his presence, and thousands of troops began converging on Coro as soon as the rebels raised their standard. The local people were mostly hostile. It seems many perceived this as an invasion by the United States, which is perhaps understandable since practically every person involved in the expedition, other than Miranda himself, was indeed a gringo. This particular idea may have been a bit ill-conceived, but Miranda was no fool. He quickly realized this affair was not going to end the way he had hoped, and began organizing an evacuation. The Spanish were able to kill or capture dozens of his men, but once again, Miranda himself slipped through their grasp. At least so far, there was little indication the people of Spanish America were just waiting to rise up and join some liberating force. Then again, the British were outsiders who had come to the Rio de la Plata mostly for their own commercial and strategic advantage. Miranda was definitely a true believer in the cause of Spanish American liberty, but the wealthy bankers and sullen gringo mercenaries he'd enlisted were unquestionably outsiders. However, Popham's failure in 1806 seems to have only whetted the appetites of the British leadership. From a certain perspective, the expedition had been a humiliation, a force of trained, experienced regulars, defeated in about a month by an improvised army of local militia. On the other hand, Popham had managed to seize the capital of the colony with barely over 1,000 men, no real plan, and no support from home. Imagine what might be achieved by an official expedition with adequate manpower and all the proper preparations. And so the British returned to the Rio de la Plata in the new year, 1807, this time well over 10,000 strong. They were well supplied, well equipped, and had learned the lessons of Popham's defeat. However, the locals were better prepared too. Those militias that had been raised during the first invasion had never disbanded. They had continued training and organizing themselves in case the enemy should return. Local authorities had built fortifications and stockpiled weapons and supplies. Still, they were facing long odds. British regulars had advantages in training and experience, and now they would have the edge in numbers as well. The Redcoats came ashore on the north bank this time, advancing on Montevideo and placing the city under siege. The British artillery pounded the defenses for days. Unlike Buenos Aires, Montevideo was a true fortified city. But the British had plenty of heavy siege artillery, and with their experienced crews, they were able to quickly silence the guns of the garrison. Then they went to work creating a breach in the walls. The Montevideo garrison tried to sally out and silence the guns. They charged forward impetuously just after dawn. According to some sources, most of the men had stayed up all night drinking to work up the courage for this audacious attack. They actually had some success, forcing the frontline British units to retreat. However, the Redcoats rallied and counterattacked. The unruly mass of militia was hit on the flank, quickly suffering hundreds of casualties. The attack disintegrated, and the survivors ran back to the safety of the walls. Despite their success, the British were in dire straits, critically low on supplies and ammunition, and suffering from disease and low morale. On February 3rd, the British commander, General Samuel Auchmuty, gathered his officers to announce that they would assault the city that night. He was quite candid about the army's situation. Quote, "I cannot ensure your success, but now or never is the moment. Our ammunition will not hold out another day. We must make one bold effort or abandon South America." End quote. And so the orders went out. As the sun set, a British colonel addressed his men, quote, "I am a damned bad hand at a speech. Spare the women and children. For the rest, you know what to do." End quote. And so, in the wee hours of the morning, the Redcoats stormed the breach under cover of darkness. The remaining Montevidean militias stood firm, and a bitter urban combat raged all night. However, the colonial militias were outnumbered more than 2-1. Soon, the British were pouring into the city from multiple directions. Some militia units fought to the last man, but there was no stopping the Redcoats. Shortly before dawn, the Montevidean authorities surrendered the city. The British paused in Montevideo to consolidate their control over the city, then crossed the Rio de la Plata and began working their way towards Buenos Aires. The landings on the far bank were led by General Robert Crawford, who would go on to achieve great fame in the Peninsular War. Those of you who are signed up on Patreon might remember Black Bob Crawford from Dispatch 28. The colonial militias detected the landing and assembled around a good defensive position at a place called Miserere, just outside Buenos Aires, hoping to stop the British before they could advance on the city. Once again, they were led by Santiago de Ligne, now royal governor. The Redcoats attacked, but soon encountered surprisingly heavy fire from the militia, including artillery. The men wavered. It seemed the attack might lose momentum. Then General Crawford himself appeared at the front. He was an imposing character, both loved and feared by his men. Not wanting to disappoint their general, the Redcoats surged forward. The momentum was regained, and the position at Miserere fell to the British. The surviving militia fell into a disorganized retreat back to Buenos Aires, pursued by the Redcoats. In the chaos, Governor Ligne himself was nearly captured, but managed to hide out in a nearby farmhouse until after dark. When he finally emerged to sneak back to Buenos Aires, he was spotted by a British patrol, and the governor had to dodge musket fire as he ran for his capital. News of the defeat at Miserere set off a panic in Buenos Aires, but it didn't last long. People seemed to have realized very quickly that all that was left for them to do was prepare for another fight inside the city itself. Barricades were built and weapons distributed to anyone willing to fight. The battle at Miserere was really more of a skirmish, but the senior British commander, General John Whitlock, seems to have believed Crawford had totally broken Ligny's force, and that the British would face no more serious opposition before they seized Buenos Aires. Despite his rank, Whitlock was very inexperienced. He had only seen a battle once in his career. His opponent in that battle had been General Étienne Laveau, who you may remember from our episodes on the Haitian Revolution, a French officer who had been a friend and close ally of Toussaint Louverture. Whitlock had actually tried to bribe Laveau into throwing the battle. Laveau had been so outraged he had tried to challenge Whitlock to a duel. Anyway, Whitlock had attained his position based on political and social connections, not merit. By this stage of the campaign, the burdens of command seemed to be weighing on him heavily. As his troops advanced on their objective, Whitlock was preoccupied with paranoid delusions that his own officers were plotting against him. It seems he was more concerned with sniffing out these imagined conspiracies than in preparing for the capture of Buenos Aires. This is one of the main reasons the British wound up adopting a half-baked plan for their assault on the city. The infantry would approach from all sides, rather than concentrating for one concerted effort. Then they would take possession of key defensive positions on the outskirts of the city, and hold them until they received further instructions. Apparently, Whitlock believed that once this first objective was achieved, an opportunity to win the battle and take the city would simply present itself. It was a laughable plan. In fact, it's not really a plan at all. The British leadership would be ordering their men into battle with no clear vision of how the victory would be achieved. When one of the senior generals began to object, Whitlock cut him off, ranting and raving about his supposed enemies trying to undermine all his proposals. Discussion over. Under Whitlock's weak, paranoid leadership, many of his subordinates would be forced to fend for themselves in the coming battle. Meanwhile, spirits were high within the city. The Bishop of Buenos Aires held an outdoor mass in a public park outside the city's bullfighting stadium, because there was not enough space in the cathedral. He told the crowd it was God's will that the Protestant heretics would be defeated. Whether or not God was on their side, Governor Ligny and his militias were ready for a fight. The British troops woke up before dawn on July 5, 1807. They would storm the defenses just before the sun rose, so they could make that dangerous final approach under the cover of darkness. One of Whitlock's aides reported that the general was agitated, talking to himself, saying that it was a bad plan that he had been forced to adopt against his will. But it was now far too late for second thoughts. The British troops took casualties as they approached the defenses, but held their nerve. After the campaign, many of the redcoats would remark on the excellent marksmanship of the Spanish colonials. Militiamen on the roofs of Buenos Aires picked off redcoats as they dashed for the city perimeter. Soon, the British had closed the distance and began establishing footholds on the outskirts of town, just as Whitlock's plan had called for them to do. However, now that the British were inside the city, the fighting had entered a new phase. Urban combat is a great equalizer. In a maze of high stone buildings and narrow, winding streets, a poorly trained militiaman, or even an armed civilian, is almost as valuable as a trained regular. An army that might advance 20 miles a day in open country might suddenly find its progress measured in blocks, or even feet. General Whitlock had believed that once his men entered the city, an opportunity for victory would present itself quickly. Instead, the British found themselves in a confusing, deadly quagmire. The fighting inside Buenos Aires is almost reminiscent of the sieges of Saragossa. Every street, sometimes every building, had to be taken with a frontal assault and cleared with the bayonet. Just like at Saragossa, women and even children joined in the fighting. When the British took one improvised fortification, the surviving defenders simply retreated to the next one. Even the local civilians threw things at the redcoats from the upper windows of their homes. Pots of boiling water, paving stones torn up from the streets below, and even crude improvised hand grenades that had been distributed by the city government before the battle. Groups of militia would lay flat on the rooftops, waiting for the British forces in the streets below to advance past them, then, at their commander's signal, stand up to deliver a devastating volley into the enemy rear. Despite this ferocious resistance, several British columns were able to advance towards the city center. However, the deeper they penetrated into the enemy defenses, the more isolated they became. Several found themselves surrounded, with no choice but to surrender. Mercifully, the fighting died down around nightfall, but neither side abandoned their positions. The British had suffered about 2,000 casualties, perhaps representing as much as 20% of their remaining forces. Their opponents had undoubtedly suffered worse casualties, and parts of the city remained under British control, but there could be no denying that the first day of fighting represented a victory for the defenders. The two sides negotiated through the night, but were unable to reach an agreement. The next morning, Royal Navy ships appeared outside the city and opened fire. If Buenos Aires could not be taken by storm, perhaps it could be bombarded into submission. However, Governor Linier went to work redeploying his artillery, and they were able to drive the ships away. Now that both the army and the navy had failed to break Buenos Aires, Whitlock assembled his officers for a council of war. The mood was pessimistic. After the bloody fighting the previous day, it was no longer clear the British had the manpower to actually take the city. And even if they did somehow prevail, how would they then hold the city and maintain order over an armed population that clearly had the will to resist? Whitlock seems to have left the meeting convinced the entire campaign was lost. Some officers objected. Even if Buenos Aires was out of their reach for the moment, they still controlled the fortified port city of Montevideo and had thousands of men at their disposal. Both good points, but as we've already seen, Whitlock did not listen to his subordinates. Later that day, he wrote in a letter, quote, "Spanish America can never be English," end quote. Whitlock wrote a proposal to Linier. In exchange for a long-term ceasefire, the British would agree to leave Buenos Aires and the surrounding area within 10 days and return to their base at Montevideo. Then, within 4 months, they would leave Montevideo too and sail back to Britain. The colonials had won. Apparently, Linier was shocked that Whitlock was willing to capitulate completely. The governor had believed they were facing a much longer struggle. Many of Whitlock's officers felt the same way. One would later recall, quote, "Of all the defeats we have ever sustained, this was the most ignoble, and the feeling in Montevideo was so intense that insulting expressions about General Whitlock, calling him both a coward and a traitor, were written upon the walls," end quote. General Crawford was furious. He resolved to see Whitlock executed for cowardice. When the expedition returned to Britain, Whitlock was severely criticized for giving up so easily. The British press of this era loved a good scapegoat, and the hapless general became their new favorite toy. The British military seemed to agree. Whitlock was court-martialed, found guilty, and dismissed from the service. Although, much to the chagrin of General Crawford, he was not executed. Once again, the people of the Rio de la Plata had been underestimated, and once again, they had taught their enemies a bloody lesson. Just as the colonial elite had feared, the experience of defending the Rio de la Plata had given the local people a new self-confidence and a new sense of their own strength. These events had begun opening people's minds to the idea of independence. It is a bit ironic, given that they had all been fighting to defend the colonial order from their self-described liberators. One Buenos Aires militia officer summed up these somewhat contradictory feelings this way, quote, "I want either our old master or no master at all," end quote. That man's name was Manuel Belgrano, which may ring a bell to those of you who know Argentinian history. A few months after Whitlock's retreat, even more exhilarating news arrived from Europe. The people of Spanish America had a new sovereign, King Ferdinand VII. Old Charles IV had abdicated, and, more importantly, his despised prime minister, the sausage maker Manuel Godoy, was gone too. Godoy was detested all over the Spanish Empire, not only in Spain itself. When they learned of his downfall, the people of the American colonies celebrated just like their cousins in Spain. As we discussed at the beginning of this episode, by and large, the people of Spanish America still saw themselves as Spanish subjects. There were some thinking about autonomy or even outright independence, but there were still no real patriotic movements to speak of. Not yet. Even those who privately harbored pro-independence sentiments mostly saw this news as a positive development. Just like in Spain, people in America were eager to turn the page on the Godoy period. They too had referred to Prince Ferdinand as El Deseado, the Desired One, because they were so impatient to see him take the throne and hopefully put the empire on a different course. They were drinking toasts to the new king in Mexico City, Lima, Bogota, and Buenos Aires, just as they were in Madrid, Barcelona, Havana, Manila, and everywhere else the Spanish flag flew. However, just like in Spain, this positive mood, touched off by the rise of King Ferdinand, was soon dashed by news of the abdications of Bayonne. The so-called Desired One had apparently given up his crown just as quickly and suddenly as he had taken it. Now their new sovereign was supposedly King Jose of the House of Bonaparte. Those feelings of joy and optimism were replaced by confusion, fear, and anger. That connection to Spain, which almost everyone had assumed would always be there, was suddenly looking very tenuous. A power vacuum began to open. Power vacuums mean danger, but also the potential for great change. Next episode, we'll explore the implications of this momentous news and hear the first shots of the Spanish-American Wars of Independence. If you're signed up on Patreon, I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. Don't forget to leave your questions in the comment section below the last bonus episode. And even if you don't have a question yourself, I would encourage you to go scroll through the questions left by others and give a like to any questions that seem interesting. I take that into account when I decide which questions to answer. As for the rest of you, I'll be back in 1 month with more from the main narrative. As always, thanks for listening.